United States of America versus Harper. Mr. Nicholson.
May it please the court, John Nicholson with Cook, Yancey, King & Galloway of Shreveport, Louisiana, for the appellant, Rodney Harper. Your Honors, good afternoon. Mr. Harper was indicted in the district court below with one count of conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute 50 grams or more of crack cocaine. I was appointed to represent him. He pleaded guilty on December 15, 2009, in connection with his plea. The government entered a plea agreement with him in which it granted him use immunity for all prospective statements to law enforcement. The first issue this appeal raises for the court's consideration is this. Did the government breach the use immunity provision of that plea agreement with its letter of March 5, 2010, which is sealed record excerpt tab D, and its letter of May 27, 2010, which is sealed record excerpt tab F. The facts pertinent to this issue begin with the pre-sentence report released to my office by the United States Probation Office on February 3, 2010. That pre-sentence report concluded that Mr. Harper should be held responsible for 18 kilograms of cocaine base for sentencing purposes, rather than the 50 or more grams of cocaine base to which he stipulated in connection with his plea agreement. The basis for the probation officer's conclusion as to the amount of cocaine base for which Mr. Harper should be held responsible was that he had stipulated to that amount in connection with the plea. This was a clear error. I called this error to the government's attention and to the probation officer's attention with my pre-sentence report objections filed on February 17, 2010.
Now, what do you do with the district judge saying that he relied on those two co-defendants, both of whom the government was aware of prior to the debriefing and the use immunity, and he says that that's what he's relying on? That, how do we get behind what the district judge says in terms of what he relied on to make his determination? I'm not talking about the breach, which is a separate issue,
Judge. Yes, Your Honor.
In terms of how do we get around the district judge saying that he based his finding as to the amount on these two people?
Your Honor, going into the June 24th, 2010 sentencing hearing, the issue was not whether, in fact, Mr. Harper was responsible for the distribution of cocaine base in an amount greater than 4.5 kilograms, which gave him a base offense level of 38. The issue was, when did the government learn of Mr. Harper's responsibility for amounts beyond the amounts to which he stipulated?
Yeah, but if this comes from an independent source, not from his statements, then the court can use those amounts, can he? And if they were aware of these co-defendants, they were of their existence, they were cooperating, and the defendant that had pled guilty was cooperating with the government, and that was even before the grant of use immunity, and the district judge relies on that, and he relies on this sequence. Why isn't that supportive of his finding that the amounts that he holds them responsible for were derived not from anything that comes out of his statements at the debriefing?
Your Honor, my appreciation of the court's case law and sentencing guideline 1P1.8 is that the government had the burden of the sentencing hearing of establishing that it knew, or specifically that it had information with sufficient indicia of reliability before Mr. Harper pleaded guilty and entered a plea agreement with the government and before he cooperated to substantiate the additional drug quantities. The fact that Mr. Green and Mr. Goldsmith
both... What you're saying is your argument that anything that the government finds afterwards necessarily not independent and necessarily comes from the statements that were made by your client at debriefing? Where is the case law for that?
Your Honor, my argument is that as the court held in United States versus Marsh, the government had the burden of establishing.
And I'm asking you, why didn't they meet the burden if the district judge says that he relies on these two people who were cooperating with the government, who the government was aware of, and prior to the time that your client is debriefed and is given use immunity?
Your Honor, if I may, I might attempt to answer your question with a hypothetical, as I must, because I don't know what the government knew or when it knew it beyond what's disclosed in the record.
But are you arguing a per se violation? Are you arguing that a breach occurred with respect to the immunized statements, and because that breach occurred, I mean, that taints any kind of factual finding or any kind of showing of independence? Is that what your argument is?
Your Honor, yes, Your Honor. The question of breach and the question of whether the government carried its burden are distinct, and my argument is that if the government breached the plea agreement with its two letters discussed in our briefs, Mr. Harper is entitled to have his sentence vacated and the case remanded for resentencing by a different judge.
Yeah, but that's a different basis.
It is a different basis.
And you
yes,
might
Your
be
Honor.
Entitled to it if there is a breach.
Yes,
right?
Your Honor.
But how does that impact the validity of a finding not based on what the use immunity, but based on things that come apart from and separate and independent from the statements that he makes at debriefing?
Your Honor, my appreciation of the case law is this. Mr. Harper pleaded guilty in December 2009, was granted use immunity, was debriefed in early January. In that debriefing, he disclosed to the government that...
I understand that.
The government had the burden of establishing that it knew not only that Mr. Goldsmith and Mr. Green were cooperating with the government, but that they had disclosed or the government had learned from some other source information with sufficient indicia of reliability to establish Mr. Harper's responsibility for the distribution of cocaine base in an amount greater than that to which he stipulated.
And you say
your
that
position that the matter of sequence controls, that is, that the government had to know that before they debriefed him, or isn't it okay if, despite his debriefing and his immunity, they subsequently learn totally independent of him from these other witnesses?
Your Honor, my position is that the government had the obligation to establish.
You understand the burden of proof. Nobody.
Yes, Your
we
Honor.
Understand your burden of proof. Are you saying that the government can't independently find out something afterwards, that it's fixed at a point in time, and that if the government didn't know that at the time of his debriefing, that it couldn't find out independently those other things later?
Yes, Your Honor. That okay. is my position.
And what is your authority that you can have no independent basis for finding further information that the government is foreclosed from even independently finding out other information?
Your Honor, my authority is Sentencing Guideline 1B1.8 and United States versus Marsh. At the end of the Marsh opinion, the court remanded the case after vacating the sentence, and in instructing the district court expressly indicated that the district court had to make a finding that any information it relied upon to determine the defendant's relevant conduct in that case was known to the government before the defendant entered the plea agreement. That is my authority.
Would you pass on to the Santabello issue?
To the breach? Yes, Your Honor, I will. Your Honor, after I filed my objections to the pre-sentence report on February 17, 2010, the government's trial counsel sent me a letter on March 5th, which is sealed record excerpt tab D, in which he indicated that if the objections I had raised were not withdrawn And at that time, the objections included the fact that the pre-sentence report misstated the quantity of cocaine to which Mr. Harper had stipulated in connection with his plea. He stated that he not only would call multiple witnesses, including Mr. Green and Mr. Goldsmith, but that he also would have the DEA agents who debriefed Harper testify that Harper himself admitted his drug trafficking and amounts of cocaine with these same co-defendants and others in the debrief.
Did he, in that communication, also say he would communicate it to the judge?
Your Honor, he, to my recollection, did not say that he would communicate to the judge in that communication, but he sent a subsequent letter on May 27th, 2010, after I refused to withdraw the objections, despite his March 5th, 2010 letter, in which he said, "This is to advise you," that was the probation officer, "and the court that the government supports the findings contained in the pre-sentence report and supports your responses to the defendant's objections." He went on to say in that same letter that the government is prepared to call the agents who debriefed Mr. Harper to testify that Mr. Harper himself admitted the quantities of cocaine that he dealt with over the course of this conspiracy, which amounts comport with your independent findings. This letter was sent to the district judge.
That's sort of it on Santabella, isn't it?
It seems to me, yes, Your Honor. This was direct use of statements Mr. Harper had made to DEA agents after being given use immunity in violation of the use immunity provision of his plea agreement. The letter sent to the district judge certainly was inconsistent with his reasonable understanding of the plea agreement that he had signed. And as I indicate in my reply brief, the May letter was more than anticipatory breach. This would be a different and perhaps a closer question if the only letter the government's trial counsel had sent was the first letter on which he did not copy the district court. Whether that letter or that type of threat alone is sufficient to constitute breach of a plea agreement entitling a defendant in these circumstances to resentencing by a different judge is a question that the court can leave for another day, because the subsequent letter, which was sent to the district court, disclosed the information, and it disclosed it for the stated purpose of bolstering the probation officer's conclusion that Mr. Harper should be held responsible for 18 kilograms of cocaine base.
What's the ultimate relief you're seeking in the sense of, assuming arguendo on one point or another, you get a remand for resentencing either before, let's say, for another judge, et cetera. The guidelines, provisions, et cetera, are pretty much going to tote up the way they are and given where he was sentenced. So there's a strong probability he could get the same or an identical sentence. I guess he could get more. But at bottom, you get a ruling, and then you get a resentencing, but the same sentence. In this instance, I mean, is it the holding, I mean, about the breach of the immunity, or the prospects of a different sentence?
A different sentence is a possibility, Your Honor, but I've advised my client of that possibility, and as is appointed counsel,
He was sentenced at the low range.
That's correct, Your
Honor. And frankly, we have some case law that says, as long as the witnesses were known before, that you can develop, as long as it's derived independently and doesn't come from the immunized or compelled statements, that that can be used. So you're in the situation where the holding him responsible for this extra amount may be upheld. He still gets the same guideline range, but the new judge, and if there's been a breach, it does seem you'd be entitled to a new judge. The new judge may not sentence him at the lower level, and I guess he knows that.
Yes, Your Honor, I've advised him of that, and he wished to pursue this appeal nonetheless.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Kassir, I assume you did not handle this at the trial level?
No, Your Honor, I did not. I just do appeals. The defendant has failed to establish that any of his proffered statements were actually used to calculate his guidelines range in the PSR. And that
they were divulged. They were used to try to support this amount in violation of the agreement.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It seems like they were used by the government to try to support this increase. There was statements about what he made, and the statements that he made were, what was the phrase that was used, to commit a fraud on the court? Where the heck did that come from?
Your Honor, the attorney was dealing with a situation in which an investigation had been going on for...
But that's not a fraud on the court. If I tell you I'm going to grant this motion to suppress and you can't use it, and then you say, well, I'm going to show the thing that was suppressed because by him making me prove this case up, he's committing a fraud on the court. All he's doing is insisting that you follow your obligation, which was your burden, to show that you're not using immunized. How is he committing a fraud on the court by holding the government to its burden?
Your Honor,
where did that language come from, that he's committing a fraud on the court?
There was information. The government in its plea agreement states that it will provide to the court all information acquired in the investigation. The government did not present, has not yet presented to the court any information that was included in defendant's proffer. But the defendant is obligated to truthfully state his role in the offense and his conduct during
the
offense.
He wasn't denying anything. He was just saying you can't use, whether he's right or wrong, he's just insisting on his right that you not use
his proffered statement.
Yes, and it wasn't just his proffered statement, it was use. You gave him use immunity, right?
Correct. Correct.
Well, why is he committing a fraud on the court by making you live up to your burden? Where does this language come from?
Your Honor, I don't know what was in the head of the person who wrote the letter at the time. I do know that the investigation was ongoing and that the district judge was fully aware of all of the parties to it. Perhaps some background information would be helpful. This defendant was one of 13 in an indictment. He was the sixth one to plead guilty. He was one of 11 charged in the conspiracy. And I believe there was just some amazement that this defendant could claim that he was only liable for the specific amounts of one transaction. And I believe that was where the language came from.
He had the right, because of the agreement that you, the government, provided him, to have you go through the burden of showing that your information was independently derived. I think you did it.
Right.
But the fact that he insists on placing the burden on who it belongs to doesn't make it a fraud on the court.
That is correct, Your Honor. The government had the burden, and the government has carried its burden at every step of the way.
Well, it carried it too far under Santabello when the assistant U.S. attorney sent a letter to the district judge with this information.
But the information was not in the letter. It was strictly that the government was willing to call the DEA agents to testify to support.
Why do you have to tell the court in advance of that? Just do it.
Well, that's
the violation of Santabello that the Supreme Court says.
And it did give the substance of it. It did say that, based upon what he said there, that it would show this amount. I mean, so it was very clear. It was very clear that the letter was referring to the statements that he made at the briefing.
The Well, I can't. The references were, in my view, were somewhat vague, though they did reference the fact that the DEA agents had taken a proffer from this defendant, and defendant was, in essence, denying the truth of his statements.
He wasn't denying anything. He was putting you to your burden.
Well, it was viewed differently because
he was roll over.
Because he was saying that he was only liable, that his guidelines range should have been only a 27, because he was only the only amounts that could be calculated were the amounts involved in the one wiretap intercept, which was mentioned in his factual basis.
And if you were using his statements, he would be correct. You couldn't use those. If you were using his immunized statements, if you didn't have an independent, he would be correct. And so that just joined the issue.
Right.
Is it common practice to send copies of these kind of letters to the court?
Your Honor, to my knowledge, no.
I hope it doesn't happen again.
Your Honor, it is not, to my knowledge, a common practice. The district judge, however, was abundantly familiar with this because he had authorized the wiretaps that had gone on. There were pen registers. He received the reports from the agents involving this.
Is he the same judge that had taken the plea of this other defendant that had implicated him?
He took the pleas of all of the defendants
that?
And presided over the trial of the one who went to trial.
Well, again, doesn't Santabello answer the point you're making where it says, we emphasize that this in no sense is in no sense to question the fairness of the sentencing judge. The fault here rests on the prosecutor, not on the sentencing judge. So it seems to me our hands are tied in light of these indisputed facts, that with what was done here in violation of the unequivocal statement of the Supreme Court in Santabello, that we must, it may be a hollow act, I don't have any idea it'll be any less sentence, but we don't have a choice but to send this back and have a different judge conduct the sentencing.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree that is totally controlled by Santabello, because the defendant in this case, I mean, the statements were not anything, did not give the judge any information that was not available to the judge already through the wiretap reports and the information
that he had from the other defendants. You're making a harmless error claim. You're not saying we didn't breach it. We're saying the judge already knew it.
Right.
We did.
Right.
You know.
The judge knew all of this. He knew he had already had, five defendants plead guilty. The full scope.
But that doesn't mean you have the right to breach your agreement. It doesn't mean that the government is relieved of its obligation, that the government can say, we're going to do something and do something different because it didn't make any difference that we did it. That's a harmless error.
The other quote is, if a breach has in fact occurred, the sentence must be vacated without regard to whether the judge was influenced by the government's action. In our case in Grandinetti, or however it's pronounced, says the same thing, regardless of the failure of the government had any effect on the sentencing judge. I don't see how we have a choice. It may be a hollow act, but
I'm firmly convinced it is.
He may give him a higher sentence.
Pardon?
He may get a higher sentence.
He may very well. And the amount of cocaine that was involved was well in excess of the 4.5 kilograms needed to get him to the level that he is now. Well in excess.
Okay. Of course, if he gets a higher sentence, he might come back up here and argue that he got it because he exercised his rights to appeal. So, you know, that might temper the government a little bit and how vigorously it argues for a whole lot more sentence, too. Especially if he draws the same pound.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Counsel, you have another swing.
Your Honors, I'll make only 2 points in rebuttal. Consistent, Judge Weiner, with your recitation of Santabello, harmless error analysis is not permitted in this circumstance. And because the government breached its plea agreement with Mr. Harper, he's entitled to be resentenced regardless of whether the breach was harmless. One of the court's precedents pertinent to that issue is United States versus Salem, 205 Federal 3rd, 764. In Salem, the government agreed with the defendant that it would not take a position as to whether multiple sentences should be run consecutively or concurrently. And despite that agreement, at the sentencing hearing, the government's counsel suggested to the district judge that he consider the defendant's extensive criminal history in deciding whether to run the sentences consecutively or concurrently. And the government, the judge took that recommendation and ran the sentences consecutively.
Let me ask you this. Was this your first case with Jim Coles on the other side?
It was, Your Honor. This was my first federal criminal case, Your Honor.
Okay. I kind of figured that. Okay. Has nothing to do with the resolution of the appeal, but I was trying to read between the lines as to why what happened happened. But at any event.
In Salem, Your Honor, on appeal, the defendant argued that the suggestion the government had made with respect to running the sentences consecutively was a breach of the plea agreement. The government responded that it was in part that it wasn't a breach because the court already had all the information that had been provided to the government, and this court held that that was irrelevant and that it was the government's attempt to influence the judge in a way that it agreed not to do was a breach of the agreement. That's the breach, and that requires the relief that appellant requests here. The second point I will make, again, as the panel has recognized, is that this appeal in no way suggests that the district judge was, in fact, improperly influenced by what the government did. The fault rests with the government's trial counsel and not with the district judge. Unless the court has further questions.
We have your argument. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We notice that you're court appointed. We thank you for your service to the court.